If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Well, so sometimes the NBA gods smile upon you and sometimes they mess with you a little bit. I recorded a fantastic conversation Thursday afternoon with Ryan McDonough, former Suns GM, and the man who, of course, drafted DeAndre Ayton a few years back. At the time we recorded, DeAndre Ayton was contemplating signing an offer sheet with the Pacers, was moving toward that. By the time the afternoon was over, by the time evening was hitting here in Las Vegas, Ayton had not only signed the offer sheet, but the Suns had matched. So Ryan McDonough and I did have a long discussion about the various implications of the offer sheet, how it would affect the Pacers, whether the Suns would match, what that does to, of course, sign and trade possibilities with the Nets in a Kevin Durant deal. That is, of course, now off the table. But I want to assure you folks, this episode, still very much worth listening to. Ryan has great insights, not only on DeAndre Ayton and some very just moving thoughts about seeing Ayton get this huge contract, a young man he's known for several years now, but also just the implications, because a lot of the implications are there regardless, even with him going back to the Suns, which of course we did not know for sure at the time that we recorded. We also discussed at length the Donovan Mitchell saga and the Jazz's apparent willingness to now move him, the Knicks' involvement, whether the Knicks have the goods to get that done. Ryan had great insights on all of that. He also has a unique, I think unique, solution that he's proposing at the end of the podcast to the superstar trade demand trend and how to maybe curtail that a little bit. Of course, if you don't know Ryan McDonough, of course, an analyst with NBA TV, with Odyssey Sports, NBC Boston, former Suns GM, long time in the front office of the Boston Celtics as well under Danny Ainge, who's now running the Jazz. So Ryan's got some good insights into how Danny Ainge operates and will be operating in these Donovan Mitchell trade talks. Before we get to all that, of course, a quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts, and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Ryan McDonough is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, pleased to be joined in person, live from Summer League, Ryan McDonough. Ryan, how are you, sir?
Howard, I'm doing great. It's always good to be with you. I feel like we've done a few of these remotely over the past few years. So with the pandemic hopefully dying down, it's great to be back in person in Summer League in Las Vegas, as this event seems to get better every single year.
I don't think we've ever actually done this in person, amazingly, so because we're not in the same city, so that stands to reason. But yes, nice to do this without the Zoom windows for once. Nice to be doing this inside where it's air-conditioned in a odd little side room at the Cox Pavilion, surrounded by beer that we are not permitted to drink as far as we know, and random pieces of cloth, something. I don't know what's going on in this room. It looks like an old-school sewing machine over there, too. Maybe there were props in here. Maybe this is the drama department's room. I have no idea.
I don't know if another basketball podcast features knitting, beer, and NBA talk at a high level like yours does, Howard. So we're setting some records and being pioneers here today.
We do it all here at The Crossover. Multi-skilled, multi-subject. So we arranged to do this a couple days ago. We've both been here for Summer League all week. And as it turns out, fortuitous timing that we're doing this in the afternoon on Thursday the 14th. By the time people hear this, it will be Friday morning at earliest. But within the last couple hours, word comes via ESPN that DeAndre Ayton, your former draft pick with the Suns, has signed an offer sheet with the Pacers. Now, this is fascinating because, you know, there's salary cap machinations. There's, I think, for lack of a better term, the political machinations of this. This has been kind of a stare down between Ayton and the Suns. The Pacers looming on the fringe of this is a team that's rebuilding that clearly sees value in him. The Nets are on the fringe of this because Ayton has been perceived to be or has potentially been a piece of a sign-and-trade in a Durant deal. And if this is all going down, it's going to take that off the table. So there's all kinds of tentacles to what in a normal summer restricted free agent signing offer sheet doesn't really, you know, move the needle much, right? This one has all kinds of tentacles. So the details, according to ESPN, four-year, $133 million offer sheet that Ayton signs with the Pacers. By the time listeners hear this, maybe we'll know more, but it's a 48-hour matching window, so we might not know more. If you had to predict right now, it's terrible to put you on the spot knowing that this podcast will come out and things may have changed already, but Suns match? Suns decline and he becomes a Pacer, or Suns in the window that they still have before he puts ink to paper, pull off the sign and trade? I think those are the only three options, right?
Yeah, I think you covered it well, Howard. As we record this, it's 5:30 Eastern, 2:30 Pacific on Thursday afternoon. And as of this moment, DeAndre Ayton still has not signed his offer sheet, which means that a sign-and-trade is on the table. Now, Indiana is committed to the four-year, $133 million contract. It seems like DeAndre's representatives, Bill Duffy and Nima Namakian, are giving the Suns and Pacers maybe a little more time to try to figure out if there's a sign and trade. So I think that's, I don't say the most likely. We don't know. We're recording this in a windowless room in the basement of an arena. I think that would make the most sense if the Suns have concerns about paying Ayton at that level. And that's one of the things that it's frustrated Ayton. It's obviously a little bit awkward for me being on the outside, but having some inside information that a year ago, the Suns had the great run to the NBA Finals. They were up 2-0 before Milwaukee, led by Giannis, had the tremendous comeback. But the team played very well. DeAndre played very well. And I think he fully expected to get a max contract or something close to that in free agency. That offer did not come last year. And I think one of the other frustrations for Ayton and his group were that the Suns paid a lot of other guys. They paid Chris Paul. They extended Devin Booker. They did an extension with Mikal Bridges last year. And this is just my opinion, Howard. I don't think those bothered DeAndre as much because those guys are excellent players. A few of them are probably headed to the Hall of Fame someday. But then some of the secondary moves the Suns made, trading for and signing Landry Shamet, bringing in Torrey Craig on a multi-year deal and a trade. I think DeAndre wants to win. He wants a good team around him, and certainly they've had a good team, maybe the best team in the league the last couple of years, going to the finals a year ago, winning 64 games this year. But I think a lot of the frustration from DeAndre Ayton and his group were just that everybody seemingly has gotten paid except for him, and that he feels like he has sacrificed as far as screening, rolling, rebounding, defending, doing a lot of the grunt work without a whole lot of plays being run through him. He still put up, you know, very good numbers, and the team's won at a high level. So I think, understandably, it's human nature that the player and his representatives will say, well, what about us? Don't forget about us. We've done a lot to earn this contract. And clearly, at least one team, the Indiana Pacers, feel like he's a max player.
By the time it gets to this point in these situations, it's pretty clear that the team that had the player's rights has dragged its feet on some level. Either they wanted the guy to go out and let the market set it, which is, I think, always playing with fire and a bad idea anyway, and it's bad messaging. You're not telling your player that you value him if you're saying go get an offer and we'll decide whether to match. So there's that aspect of it. But given everything we already knew or think we knew, rumors, murmurings over the last year or so, it seemed clear for a while that there was a divide here between Suns front office slash ownership and DeAndre Ayton and his representation. Based on all of that, I have to believe that they're not going to match. I have to believe that there's of the three possible outcomes here, that one's off the table, and it's either they decline and he walks away for nothing, which would be shocking and self-defeating and frankly stupid, or they figure out the sign-and-trade, which at least recoups some sort of assets. I don't know what – I haven't looked recently at what the Pacers have. They just waived a bunch of guys in preparation for this, but those were not guys who would have been essential to a trade, I don't think, anyway. And actually, I guess they couldn't have been aggregated again anyway also. But we have two options left, Ryan. I mean, do you think there's any chance that the Suns pull off? Like I said, I'm taking the match off the table. I don't think they're matching. I could be wrong. Do you think that they figure out a sign and trade? And how willing would Ayton even be and his camp be to that at this point, given how long the Suns have kind of slow-walked this or indicated a lack of interest? I mean, Ayton has no incentive. And just to be clear before I throw this back to you, for people who've been following the league a long time, there was a time when a guy with bird rights could get the extra year and the extra raises by participating in a sign-and-trade. There's now basically zero incentive for a player to participate unless, these are some ancillary stuff, but there's no financial incentive for DeAndre Ayton to participate in a sign-and-trade. So given all that, again, what do you expect the outcome is going to be now?
So the Suns were the only team in the league, Howard, who could have given DeAndre Ayton a five-year contract. Either at a max level or a sub-max level. As far as I understand, that was not offered. So then it comes down to a four-year contract with the Suns versus a four-year contract with somebody else. And Indiana clearly feels like this guy's a max player. They value him at that level. I know the Pacers are excited about their young core, led by Tyrese Halliburton, who they acquired from Sacramento last year, and then Benedict Mathurin, the wing they got from University of Arizona. So they think Ayton will be a terrific front court fit along those guys. And to me, Howard, where this should end up is a sign-and-trade, where the Suns get some value back. Because for Ayton, the contract is the same, whether he signs the offer sheet and the Suns don't match or the Suns do match. The contract's the same. It's the same contract in a sign-and-trade. And so what the sign-and-trade does is it guarantees that DeAndre Ayton is an Indiana Pacer. You know, that the Suns takes the matching option off the table. One thing to keep an eye on is I believe the Pacers have all of their own future first-round picks. They also have an additional first-round pick that they got from the Boston Celtics in the Malcolm Brogdon trade recently. So those could be in play, their own picks. And as you know, sometimes teams get creative with the picks, the best of, the worst of, depending on the negotiation. So I imagine that's what's happening now between the Pacers and Suns. That's what should happen, at least over the next X number of hours here before Ayton officially signs the offer sheet. And, I think the other factor here, Howard, that we need to discuss is once a player is told to go get an offer sheet and the organization does not feel like he is a max player, well, then clearly the Indiana Pacers do feel he's a max player. They gave him the offer sheet. What's it like if the Suns match and he has to come back into that locker room, right? In the player empowerment era, we saw some of the tension and friction with Monty Williams in Game 7 of the Western Conference semifinals when the Dallas Mavericks eliminated the Phoenix Suns. It was obviously a tough night for the Suns all around. Everybody looked bad, but that situation between Ayton and Williams seemed to blow up. And then Monty Williams after the game said, it was an internal decision. He was a little bit abrupt with his answer. So it seems like there are some, issues there. And as you know, and this is one of the things that seemingly was discussed this week here in Las Vegas at the Board of Governors meetings, in the player empowerment era, if the Suns were to match an offer sheet, they could not trade DeAndre Ayton until January 15th. What would it be like, you know, from now till January 15th? Would they trade him, you know, match and then trade him around the trade deadline or next offseason? These are all things you need to think about as an organization. But, you know, this is not something, obviously, I think the Suns wanted to happen. They wanted this to stall for business reasons, to see if they could hang in there in the Kevin Durant sweepstakes, unless they're able to put together some mega 3 or 4 team deal with the Brooklyn Nets in the next few hours. It looks like this is going to hurt them with KD, unless they're able to recoup a draft asset or something of value from the Pacers in a sign and trade where Ayton goes to Indiana, but the Suns get something else, and then maybe that something else helps them bring in Kevin Durant either now or in the future.
All right, I want to get to the Pacers piece of this, and I want to come back around to the Suns and kind of the how we got here element of this, but let's talk about the Nets for a minute since you brought that up. This would seem to, well, one, this definitely looks like DeAndre Ayton's camp, Bill Duffy and his group, are kind of forcing the issue here. Like, it's listen, we've waited long enough. We've given you guys some time to figure out sign-and-trade possibilities, Kevin Durant possibilities, multi-team possibilities, or whether or not you even want to just sign him yourself and bring him back, period. This is speeding things up, or it's just bringing things to a head. And as you note, there's not much time now to go fashion some multi-team deal where the Nets get something. If the Nets, as has been kind of messaged through the media, aren't interested in Ayton, well, then Ayton could still go sign and trade somewhere else. You've moved these pieces around. It doesn't look like that's going to happen, Ryan. It looks like that's off the table. So the first big loser in this whole thing, it seems like, would be Kevin Durant, who wants to go to the Suns, and the Nets getting a team taken off the board potentially. Now, I could reverse that and say that it's a win for the Nets because they could say to Durant, sorry, we tried. There's nothing there now. Because Ayton, if they match, as you say, can't be traded until January 15th. If they don't match and he's a Pacer, what else do the Suns have left? Even if, as you were saying, the Suns recoup some picks in a sign-and-trade from the Pacers, well, those picks could help sweeten a deal with the Nets. But is the Nets want to stay competitive. So Mikal Bridges and picks and what? Like, even Ayton and Bridges was perceived to not be enough. Is Bridges and Cam Johnson and some picks enough? I don't see it. So tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that this has just thoroughly screwed with all these options about Durant and the Suns and one solution for the Nets coming off the board.
No, you're right. And one other mitigating factor is, as far as an Ayton in-season trade, DeAndre Ayton cannot be traded from the Phoenix Suns if the Suns match the offer sheet but to 28 teams until January 15th, but he can't be traded to the Indiana Pacers for 1 year. So it's not like they could match and then say, well, why don't they work out a deal between January 15th and the trade deadline in season?
Sure.
They can't with the Pacers. It'd have to be at the earliest next offseason, which, as you know, Howard, in this league, how quickly things change in one calendar year. So it's complicated. One of the things I've wondered, and I may be in the minority here, but I wonder if the Brooklyn Nets want to trade Kevin Durant or if they're setting a bar so incredibly high. And in my opinion, I think that bar got even higher after Utah got what they ended up getting for Rudy Gobert, that the Nets say, okay, yeah, give us 7 first-round picks and pick swaps and a good all-star in his prime and a young player, a package that no team really has or would offer. And then, because if you look at the rest of the Nets moves, Howard, in my opinion, and you mentioned it, their win-now moves. Re-signing Patty Mills, re-signing Nick Claxton, bringing in T.J. Warren. You know, their win-now moves. Kyrie opted in.
Traded for Royce O'Neal.
You gave up a draft asset for Royce O'Neal. It's important for your listeners to keep in mind, too, that the Nets cannot be bad because they owe their unprotected first and pick swaps to the Houston Rockets over the next 5 years. So I strongly feel, as a former executive with the Celtics and Suns, that Brooklyn's best option is to set an incredibly high bar. If somebody can pull multiple rabbits out of hats and match it, then maybe they do trade Kevin Durant. Most likely, or almost certainly, no team is able to come up with all that stuff, because we're talking about one of the all-time great players in his prime who has 4 years left on a contract with no options, and we know what he's capable of if he's healthy. So the Nets, sometime maybe in August or early September, around Labor Day, go to Kevin and say, look, we tried. We value you more than any other team in the league does. But look at these moves. One interesting idea that was mentioned by Eddie Johnson the other day, my former colleague with the Phoenix Suns and also with SiriusXM, is that he wonders if it would behoove the Brooklyn Nets to get Kevin Durant on the court with Ben Simmons, if and when Simmons is physically and mentally healthy, to get him excited about the possibilities and remember how talented that guy is, if he's right. So I've been in the minority all along. I've looked at the betting markets with the Suns as, you know, incredibly heavy favorite to get Durant and the Miami Heat and all that. I think he's a Brooklyn Net. And now, I people could play this back and throw egg in my face, and I'd understand that. But if I were in the Nets front office, and it's easy for me to say doing an interview here with you in the bowels of Cox Pavilion in Las Vegas, but if I were the Brooklyn Nets, you know, you'd probably go through the process and then sometime later in the summer say, Kevin, we love you. I'm sorry, you know, we're sorry. Both sides have made mistakes. The relationship has gotten to this point. Let's fix it. We have a championship contending team. We want to build around you. Give us a chance. We tried to trade you, but we couldn't.
Yeah. I've had that sense too, and I can't say that it's, you know, based on a deep amount of intel. I have some, you probably have some, but yeah, no one gets the sense that there's any urgency there, nor should there be, because even if they decide they do want to trade him, I've said the same thing. The same premise applies to Sean Marks and the Nets that applied, in my view, to Daryl Morey and the Sixers when it came to Ben Simmons. You don't make the deal just for the sake of solving this problem or just for the sake of alleviating the headache. You ride it out, you deal with whatever you got to deal with. And I think the Sixers, look, we can debate whether or not they got the right deal with swapping Simmons for Harden, but it is the deal that they wanted, and they weren't going to make a deal that they didn't want. And the same thing applies as far as I'm concerned. I will defend the Nets and Sean Marks to the end if they do this in a way that prioritizes the best possible return for them, because that's their first responsibility. It's not just to offload Durant and let him go where he wants and take back some lesser package. So I think they're doing this the right way, or what's right for the Nets. And I do think if you asked me, and somebody did the other day, like, what's the most likely outcome? I said, the most likely outcome, or if you're going to say which team he's most likely to be with on opening night, I'm still going with the Nets. Doesn't mean I think that that's absolutely going to happen. It just means that of all the other options out there, or the all other conceptual possibilities, it still seems like that's the most likely one, because we've already gotten to this point where there is no clear trade partner, and it's difficult for anybody to provide the value that they want. I want to come back to that, and I want to come back to his value, but let's go back to Ayton just for a minute to tie a bow on a couple of these things. What's the Pacers' thought process here? Because they have Miles Turner. They've already offloaded last season Sabonis. There was a long time, notion around the league that you had to break them up. They broke them up. But then Turner was still in trade rumors too. Is this the first step toward a divorce from Miles Turner, also to a new future of Tyrese Haliburton and DeAndre Ayton as your two pillars, and now they're going to flip Turner for some stuff? Or do you think there's some scenario where Turner and Ayton play together?
I am guessing, and it's not a complete guess, with a little bit of inside information, that the Pacers either have or think they can quickly put together a deal that's acceptable to them for Miles Turner. Because Miles Turner, not only is he a center, he's in the last year of his contract, he's going to be an unrestricted free agent, he's also represented by the same agency, Bill Duffy, BDA, as DeAndre Ayton. So I strongly feel like there's been some collaboration between the groups and an understanding. However, if you're in Indiana's front office, the scenario obviously you do not want to happen is you trade Miles Turner before Ayton's situation is resolved. Let's say he does go the offer sheet route with the Suns. The Suns match the offer sheet. Well, then you don't have Ayton or Turner, and then you've set your franchise back. So I think, again, it's just a guess with some inside information. I would anticipate that if Ayton is a Pacer, either via the Suns not matching an offer sheet, or more likely, as we've discussed, via sign and trade, then Turner is somewhere else. But if Ayton does go back to Phoenix, then I think Turner is a Pacer, and then the groups, the front office, coaching staff, Bill Duffy and his guys, work with Miles and say, look, this isn't anti-Miles Turner. It's more contractual, longevity, age, because Ayton's a few years younger than Turner, and, just try to put their arm around him. That's it's an awkward position, obviously, for the franchise, but that does happen in the NBA, and, I don't know Miles that well, but he seems like, one of the more intelligent, thoughtful guys in the league. I remember going back to the 2015 pre-draft process, spending some time with him. He's a really sharp guy, so I think he understands it and understands, maybe a little bit hurt about why the Pacers would give an offer sheet to DeAndre Ayton, but understands the business of it and realizes that, you know, heading into a contract year, he wants to play well and get paid, whether it's in Indiana or somewhere else.
Well, and in a case like this, it's actually to his benefit that he and Ayton share the same agent. You could perceive it as being awkward, but it actually has the added benefit of Bill Duffy knowing exactly what the Pacers are thinking and him being able to hopefully explain that in a way that is not, you know, alienating his other client. Like, but he has more intel than if Miles Turner were represented by a different agency. And so, you know, that Bill Duffy might be brokering both sides of this, you know, probably just to everybody's benefit, I could argue. And yes, it seems to obviously to be, I didn't really believe that Turner and Ayton would be destined to play together in today's NBA, although some teams are trying to veer toward bigger front courts and all that. Doesn't seem, and Miles Turner can shoot the three, so who knows? But no, seems like this is step one. So chances are, if things play out the way we think they're going to, and there's no match from Phoenix, then by Sunday, Monday, we're probably going to be awash in Miles Turner trade rumors or an actual trade. Like, as you say, they've probably already got a couple of options lined up that they're confident they can do to have gotten this far along. So that'll be interesting. And then, hey, that's a really intriguing new foundation that they have built on the fly of to go from Sabonis and Turner and Brogdon to Haliburton, Ayton. Like, too soon for us to start praising Kevin Pritchard and staff for that. But like, I kind of like that rebuild on the fly they've done there. And the Pacers are one of those teams that have kind of under the Simons ownership have never wanted to tank, never wanted to you know, bottom out. That's a pretty impressive rebuild around two really promising young players.
Yeah, I'd say three, actually. I'd add Ben Mathurin from Arizona, their lottery pick, into that mix as well. A lot of the evaluators around the league who I respect, and when I watch Mathurin play either on TV or breaking down the film, he's an intriguing young prospect as well. We'll see what happens with the rookie. He only has a couple summer league games under his belt. But yeah, there is some young talent there, no question, especially if Ayton's on the roster, as we anticipate. And so you're right. I think Indiana felt like they had hit their ceiling. And we've seen this, obviously, this offseason with Utah and the Western Conference. I always think those two franchises, I kind of group the Pacers and Jazz together in my head, Howard, for some reason. And I think it's because not free agent destinations, but historically very well run, do an excellent job scouting, drafting, developing players, usually with limited financial resources. And they're almost always pretty good. You know, they're almost always pretty good. Maybe not championship contending, but good. So we've seen in the Western Conference, Utah start to turn it over this offseason, and we'll see what happens, obviously, with Donovan Mitchell. But yeah, the Pacers, I think they felt like that team, which was a good team. You know, Malcolm Brogdon, Victor Oladipo, TJ Warren, Sabonis, Turner, that team had peaked as a team that was a consistent playoff team. But their ceiling was maybe winning one round in the playoffs and then losing in the Eastern Conference semifinals. And those are always hard discussions internally, organizationally. You hope that you have the support of ownership, especially when you pivot, as the Jazz have and as the Pacers now have, that, you know, if we do this, this is going to be a multi-year process. We have, you know, we think a decent amount of young talent on the roster now, but the short-term results are clearly going to be worse than they have been, especially a team like Utah that's been in the playoffs 6 years in a row. Is ownership on board with that? And the question, obviously, you ask, Howard, as an executive or as a coach, is even if they're okay with it today, will they be okay with it in season if we're 20 games under 500? Will they be okay with it in a year or two if we're still losing and rebuilding? Those are the hard questions in the NBA. Obviously, I've been through it on rebuilds in Boston and Phoenix. I didn't get to see the one through with the Suns, but those are the questions that you ask, and it's always in the back of your mind is, even if it's the right thing for the franchise, are we going to get to see this through, and are we going to be able to hit the bottom quickly enough and hopefully come back up at a rapid pace?
Yeah. All right, so let's get to the elephant in the room, that the player that you drafted number one overall when you were still GM of the Suns is the guy we're now talking about as being the subject of today's biggest NBA news, the guy who's, you know, he's either going to end up with the Pacers or he's probably almost certainly ending up with the Pacers, and a bunch of ripple effects as we've discussed. I think the question that still is lingering for all of us, to the extent that you can answer, that you're comfortable with the insights that I know you have with those ties to the organization, but like, how did we get here? Like, I still don't quite understand. There are a couple, and this happens in the NBA sometimes, right? We don't always get all the answers that we would like to get. I'm still not entirely clear on why Kevin Durant thought he needed to leave the Golden State Warriors a few years back. I'm still not entirely clear why he wants to leave the Nets right now. It's a little muddled. We don't always know everything. All we know about the Ayton situation is what you alluded to earlier, which was Monty Williams after they got eliminated, saying, you know, it's internal about whatever went on between him and Ayton. Ayton not playing that much in the elimination game. Ayton not having gotten his contract extension when he should have or could have earlier. Everybody else in the league kind of feeling like, looking at them going, what are you doing? This guy was the number one overall pick. He's shown a lot of promise. He's a two-way player. By the way, I know folks in Denver will be thrilled with this because they consider Ayton to be one of the, I would not say if not the best, probably he and Embiid would be the two best defenders against Jokic. And they're in the same conference, the Suns and Nuggets. So they're going to be thrilled to see Ayton going somewhere else. So around the league, I don't think anybody understands what the Suns are doing here. Any light you can shed on this, and secondarily, that on just on a personal level, I mean, every GM has a little bit of an investment that lingers, even when you're still not with the team anymore. I know this is the case where the guys you picked, the guys you signed, there's a little bit of attachment there. You want to see them succeed that much more. There's a belief that obviously fueled picking a guy. So what do you think has gone on here, and how do you perceive it through the lens also of being the one who drafted him?
One of the things I was just thinking about, Howard, that's a source of pride for me personally, and as you were talking, I picked up my iPhone and got my calculator out. I believe the three guys who remain in Phoenix, so we'll see what happens with DeAndre Ayton, but Devin Booker, Mikal Bridges, and DeAndre Ayton, those three guys from when I was GM of the Suns, if my math is correct, and these are approximate numbers, but between Mikal Bridges' extension at $90 million last offseason, Devin Booker signing an extension with the Suns that I think was at $202 million this offseason, and now DeAndre Ayton getting this four-year $133 million offer sheet from the Indiana Pacers, by my math, Howard, that is $425 million worth of contracts the guys we brought into the Suns have signed over the last couple of years. So that's a source of pride for me, because not only because it's it looks good on my resume or whatever else, but I know those guys. I know their families. I know that that's life-changing money. Not just for the player and their immediate family, but this is generational wealth. For their kids, their grandkids. So to me, like, I don't want to get emotional, but that's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. and so, yeah, just happy for DeAndre, his mom. I didn't expect to get emotional, but knowing what they've gone through to get to this point is it's cool. It's pretty neat.
No, and clearly, I knew instinctively that GMs, as I say, my experience in this league is that there's always a little bit more attachment and investment in the belief in these players, and also knowing their families. And so I knew that. I didn't realize it was that deep for you. But you were clearly moved by knowing what this means for him and his family, because you got to know them during that whole pre-draft process. And there's a lot that goes into that. And obviously, you guys had some years together there. So that's actually, honestly, that's very cool. This is a human business, and we all lose track of it, especially at a time like this where the offseason is all about transactions. It's all about people being thrilled with all the rumors and the discussion and the debates that we have. And we throw around all these numbers and we all start playing with the trade machine. But these are human beings with backstories and feelings and families and hopes and dreams. And your emotional reaction just now, Ryan, brings it back to what this sport is really about. These are about human beings and their aspirations and getting to see that come to fruition for DeAndre Ayton and his family. And it's clearly moving to you. So, I think it's cool because it reminds us that this game is about much more than just the NBA is a business. It is. Yeah. We get it. But there's so much more to this. So wherever DeAndre Ayton ends up, this is a huge moment for him.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm better now. But I was just thinking about DeAndre and his mom growing up in the Bahamas, moving to Phoenix, moving around, different high school teams, AAU teams, some of the controversy at Arizona, the path that he has taken to get to this point, $133 million. And, with that combined per his rookie scale, I'd have to look at the exact numbers, Howard, but yeah, he's going to make well over $150, $160 million before he approaches his late 20s. So he could get, another contract or two and be well north of $300 million in career earnings by the time his career dones. Devin Booker is at that level. We'll see what happens with Mikal Bridges. So that's the cool part of it. I remember Devin was 18 when we brought him in, the youngest player in the draft class in 2015. We probably weren't very smart. We brought him off the bench at first behind Eric Bledsoe, ran a night. Some of these guys played him, slow played him, and by the time he got in the starting lineup, the rest is history. So to watch his ascent, Bridges, runner-up for Defensive Player of the Year, got that $90 million deal. I remember I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again briefly. One of the worst, best and worst moments combined in my NBA career was having to call Mikal Bridges on the night of the 2018 draft and inform him that he was not actually a Philadelphia 76er, that he was not going to stay in Philadelphia, where he'd won two national championships at Villanova, where his mom worked for the 76ers franchise, that he was actually coming a couple thousand miles to the Southwest to the Phoenix Suns. And to his credit, he and his mom and everybody around them, Sam Goldfeder's agent, they handled it great. But those are like the memories that come up with Devin, Mikal, now with DeAndre. And yeah, so it's cool. I mean, I wish those guys would stay together in Phoenix forever. I'm biased, but you know, whether it's in Indiana or somewhere else, I want to see them do well. Not just because we drafted them or whatever, but because they're really good dudes.
Where do the Suns even go from here? I mean, I know you always want to be respectful of the fact that you have in your time since leaving the Suns have tried not to be overly critical or anything else. You've always been a very, very professional about it. And so I know you don't want to necessarily go there. If I had any other talent expert, former GM, whatever, in that seat today, I'd be saying, especially if they are former and out of the league, where it's a safe distance, right? GMs are never going to criticize on the record across the league. But any other expert sitting in that seat right now, I'd be saying, what the hell are the Suns doing? Have they just blown it completely? I'm trying not to put you on the spot in that way, but it does beg the question. So I'll leave it more open-ended, which is like a where do they go from here? Because this losing him, not knowing if and when they're going to get anything back in a sign and trade, if that'll even happen, this is a massive step backward. This guy was a critical piece of a team that went to the finals and that just won 64 games in the season after going to the finals. And Chris Paul is not getting any younger. And I look at this, and to me, just as just the pundit from the sidelines who has no stake in any of this, like I'm looking at them going, all right, Suns, back to the second tier for you, especially with some other teams in the West getting better.
Well, if you want an honest answer, we're recording this in a room with, I see some Sapporo and Heineken and some beers over here.
So still that option.
Maybe give me a little bit, a few of those.
I knew we should have been drinking first.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, it's Vegas, so what's 3 o'clock in the afternoon? It's probably a happy hour somewhere.
For sure.
But no, with Phoenix, it's been challenging for me. I mean, look, the team has been great. I give them a lot of credit. I think over the last 2 years, really since the Orlando bubble, you could make an argument that they've been the best team in the NBA. Now, they haven't won a championship, obviously, but 8-0 in the bubble, going to the finals a year ago, 64 wins this year. They've been really good. And I guess, my frustration, my observation just from afar now is when you're at a championship level or close to a championship level, it's so fragile, and that window closes so quickly. It opens and closes. We were lucky in Boston when I was with the Celtics that for 5 or 6 years we had a chance to compete for championships and went to 3 Eastern Conference Finals, 2008, 10, and 12, 2 NBA Finals, 8 and 10, and then we won in 2008 against the Lakers. We lost in 2010. But that run, that 5 or 6 year run was really special. And frankly, Howard, we weren't sure it was going to last that long because of the ages of our star players, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett. Those guys, aged tremendously and played very well, well into their 30s. So I bring it up because as I look at the league, and especially the Western Conference, the two LA teams aren't going to miss the playoffs again. Lakers and Clippers. Denver, if they're healthy, they're going to be really good. There'll be some drop-off, say Utah, for example, won't be as good, but New Orleans is a young up-and-coming team with Zion Williamson on the roster. Memphis obviously has the unfortunate injury to Jaren Jackson Jr. to start the year, but they're young and talented. So I bring it up because those windows are so fleeting. And when you have a 37-year-old point guard going on 38 and Chris Paul, who's one of the all-time greats and has defied the odds and the aging curve and all that to a historic level, how long can he keep doing that? How long can he be that guy? And when Chris Paul is no longer that guy, is a team led by Devin Booker and Mikal Bridges, without Chris, without, theoretically anyways, DeAndre Ayton, are they good enough to win a championship? I hope so, because I love those guys and I'm biased. They're like my sons, but I probably have my doubts about whether they are or not. So, you know, that's the tough part. I think whenever you have a chance to compete for championships, you have to take advantage of it and then also try to keep that window open as long as you can. And then so for me, and full bias, you know, disclosed, with Booker's age and Bridges' age and Ayton's age, I thought and hoped they'd have a longer runway than it seems like they will. But maybe the Suns surprise us and match the offer sheet, and they are together for the next 4 or 5 years. But we shall see.
Yeah, and if they don't, they still have the fact of not having a center, basically. Like Bismack Biyombo is not starting and playing 38 minutes a night, I don't think. And JaVale McGee's already gone to Dallas. So, like, what do they have left? What are their options in mid-July, having waited this long for this thing to resolve itself? So, I don't know. It feels to me like in the moment – and again, they've made a lot of good moves the last couple of years. They may have some other plan that we are not privy to, and it may manifest in the next couple of days. But as of right now, it looks like they have kind of screwed themselves. All right, moving on to a couple other teams and situations before I let you go. I was going to ask you, as I was typing up some notes about 24 to 27 hours ago, the Jazz, having traded Rudy Gobert, having ripped off the Band-Aid, having decided this is not going any further than it's gone, it's time to try something new, they're still sitting there with Donovan Mitchell, putting out the, you know, kind of the messaging out there, like, oh, no, they're ready to hold on to Donovan Mitchell. I was always skeptical of that, and then, lo and behold, sometime yesterday afternoon, report coming from The Athletic that, from ESPN, the first report was ESPN saying that there's a possibility, or they're not deflecting, or they're not turning away offers, or whatever, and then it became The Athletic saying they're engaged directly with the Knicks, the Jazz. Knowing that there's always, you know, a fair amount of smoke before we see fire in this league, and things can change very quickly. It might change by the time I hit stop on this recorder even. One, do you think it's a given that the Jazz are trading Donovan Mitchell? That trying to rebuild around him on the fly seems like a very steep climb, at least to me. They got back a boatload of stuff for Rudy Gobert, but Donovan Mitchell and the current surrounding cast is not a playoff or even a play-in team, and that's an awful lot of cobbling together assets and cashing in for veterans on the fly if you're trying to rebuild around him. Plus, in this league, when you have a star of Donovan Mitchell's caliber at this stage of their career, the clock is always ticking. And so how long do you realistically have to become good enough again before he starts agitating to get out, as opposed to you proactively moving him? So I feel like the clock is already ticking. The clock already was ticking before they pulled the Gobert trade. It's ticking louder now. And so there's only one of two options, I think. Like, you either rebuild on the fly so that you don't have him get disillusioned, or you just move him now. Okay, so now, 24 hours ago, it starts to sound like they have chosen that option. They are trying to move him now. Do you suspect we're going to see him traded sometime in the pretty near future? Are the Knicks the most logical destination? And I don't mean for Donovan Mitchell, who clearly has New York ties, but are they the most logical destination even as a trade partner for Utah, given whatever it is they might want to get back?
Yeah, all good questions, Howard. And I would say that I think it is likely the Jazz trade Donovan Mitchell at some point this offseason. Obviously, we're in the prediction business, and we don't know for certain. A lot of that, or most of it, frankly, will depend on the offers that Danny Ainge and his group in Utah receive as far as compensation, and is the package good enough. But I think if you take a step back and look at the totality of the Jazz's moves the last few years since Ryan Smith and Dwayne Wade and their group took over the franchise, it's headed this way toward a rebuild, toward a pretty significant rebuild. Starting with Dennis Lindsay, a longtime, very successful head of basketball operations, did a tremendous job departing the franchise. Then Quinn Snyder left, obviously, at the end of the season. And I have to imagine, obviously, we weren't in that room, but those were some of the reasons for Quinn departing the franchise, was that, hey, look, we're likely to break this down and lean into a rebuild. The franchise has been in the playoffs 6 years in a row. They've won, at least in the first round, a few of those years. They've been one of the more consistently good teams in the NBA for the better part of the last decade. But we're going to spin into a rebuild. Are you okay with that? It seemed like, you know, like a lot of veteran successful coaches, that's not something, you know, he necessarily wanted to do in UTEP. So I preface it that way. And then also, you know, you're talking to a guy who worked for Danny Ainge for a decade, and I know how he operates. There's nobody better at getting value in trades, especially when he has, you know, a talented player to trade like Donovan Mitchell. We saw what he did with Minnesota in the Rudy Gobert deal, and also in Brooklyn with Royce O'Neal, who we discussed earlier. So I think if the Jazz, and they have a good group led by Danny Ainge, if and when they look at it objectively, say, how are we going to keep Donovan Mitchell happy with the rest of the moves they've made, especially given how much success Donovan has had basically since day one when he entered the NBA. I believe they've been in the playoffs every single year. They've had a chance to compete for championships. They haven't gotten to the Western Conference Finals or the NBA Finals, but they certainly had teams that were at least theoretically good enough to do that. They've tried to do that. Now, if you're kind of going the wrong way down the mountain, even if it's the best thing for the franchise, is Donovan going to lose his mind? Or, you know, something like, how's he going to react to that when the guys he built this with, Rudy Gobert, Royce O'Neal, Joe Ingles, are gone? You know, I don't think Donovan probably cares as much about the future pick value or how Walker Kessler will develop. You know, he's like most NBA veterans in their prime. He wants to win now. So yes, that's the challenge. But one, you know, complicating factors to make it more confusing, Howard, is, as a former executive, we're getting to a part in the offseason and free agency, as we're now in week three of the free agent period, where it does become more difficult to make trades. Obviously, Donovan Mitchell's the kind of player that teams will drop everything and put plans on pause, and it looks like the Knicks are doing that. But week three of free agency, and especially the later we get in the offseason, it's important for your listeners to keep in mind that anybody who got signed this offseason a free agent is not eligible to be traded until December 15th at the earliest. Some are not eligible to be traded until January 15th. So that's a significant part of the NBA player pool that's just not available in trades. And then you also have the difficult issues financially with teams. They spent their cap space. They made deals that put them in luxury tax. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I think Mitchell will be traded. I think he is the player that's good enough that franchises like the New York Knicks, who have acquired a number of draft assets, will put plans on pause and be super aggressive trying to pursue. And so now the question for me just becomes, when does Utah get an offer good enough to pull the trigger? I think it'll be this offseason, because I think the market for Donovan Mitchell is more robust than it was for Rudy Gobert. And again, we saw what Danny Ainge and company in Utah were able to get for Gobert, a tremendous haul of players, picks, swaps. I think the price for Mitchell is even higher.
Could be. And look, the Knicks, to their credit, have amassed a bunch of picks, and those will be attractive. If Danny Ainge wants to challenge Sam Presti's record for largest cache of future first-round picks, he might just challenge him if he can extract enough from the Knicks on that end. But you're going to want players, too, I would think. I imagine that, opinions are varied around the league on R.J. Barrett, but R.J. Barrett is obviously their best young player. And the one player they're going to want to keep because, you know, now a core of Donovan Mitchell, Jalen Brunson, who they just signed, and R.J. Barrett is the start of something. I don't know what that is exactly, but it's the start of something. And you know, I don't know what else they have. You know, everybody else, they're good. Like, it's some collection of Toppin, Quickly, Grimes, McBride, what, like, that group. I mean, I guess it's a little bit akin to what they got from the Timberwolves for the Gobert trade, in that a bunch of good players, but not game changers, right? Rotation guys. And the Knicks players are younger with some upside. Again, depending on how Danny Ainge feels about the upside of Obi Toppin or Quentin Grimes or whoever. I imagine if Donovan Mitchell is just up for bid now, up for grabs, it seems to me that there should be something more attractive out there than a boatload of picks and some of those players whose futures I think aren't that clear. Like, they're good players, but I don't know how many of the guys I just named are actually going to be 10-year starters in the league.
I agree with that, and I think if I'm in the Jazz front office, it's pretty simple. If R.J. Barrett's not in the deal, then we don't have a deal. I don't think the rest of that stuff is good enough. I mean, you're talking about an all-star in his prime in Donovan Mitchell, who plays a position and a style that is attractive to every team in the league. And I say that not to cast aspersions on Rudy Gobert, but Rudy's more of a polarizing player that, you know, pronounced strengths and weaknesses. Certain teams love him and value him. Clearly the Timberwolves do. Other teams, didn't value him quite as highly. I think most teams, if not almost all of them, value Donovan Mitchell very highly. So then the question becomes, from an executive standpoint is if we're trading a young star in his prime who's under contract, and by the way, even though it's a max contract, those numbers are going to look pretty good as the salary cap continues to ascend. We need to get somebody who theoretically at least could be as good as him someday. And so if you look at just my opinion, look at the Knicks roster, RJ Barrett's that guy. The other guys are, you know, I mean, are they starters? I'm not trying to bag on the Knicks, you know, but Emmanuel Quickley, Quentin Grimes, McBride, Toppin, you know, this guy, you can make an argument that they're maybe low-end starters or high-end bench players. Maybe they're rotational players, but we're talking about one of the 20 best players in the league, you know, under contract for a number of years. And then, so the reason I bring it up is because the other calculation, obviously, as an executive is, okay, we'll get all these picks. Picks are nice. But if we let the Knicks retain the core of a team in the Eastern Conference that has a chance to be in the top four or five in the East every year, well, then we got a bunch of okay prospects and picks that are likely to be in the 20s. That's not good enough for Donovan Mitchell. So that's the challenge. And I'm interested to see, obviously, anytime there's a star for trade, Miami Heat are mentioned, how do the Utah Jazz value Tyler Herro? Are they willing to take back Duncan Robinson's contract to make the money work with some other stuff included? And then a couple teams that are under the radar because I think they're not in marquee markets, but New Orleans Pelicans have quietly done a really good job amassing talent. They still have draft assets coming in from the Lakers because of the Anthony Davis trade. If you look up and down their young roster, they're littered with talent, you know, led by Zion Williamson, who just signed the extension, but Herbert Jones. You know, really all the rookies last year, Trey Murphy's not as far as long, Alvarado, those guys really played nice roles in the playoffs and showed that they were, you know, playoff caliber players, and New Orleans has other stuff as well. So are the Pelicans in the mix? And then you mentioned earlier Oklahoma City. It doesn't look like they're going to go that path, you know, Howard, but at some point Sam Presti and company are going to push the button and be able to outbid anybody. That's just the way it is, especially from a draft compensation perspective. So are Presti and staff looking at it and saying, okay, well, we have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Donovan Mitchell. That's one of the best young backcourts in the league. And then we can start, is now the time to start spinning off all the future draft picks, things like that. The challenge is, again, at this late stage in the offseason, it's tough to kind of pivot and you know, chart a different course. But at some point, I think over the next year, probably more likely next offseason, Sam Presti will do that and will be able to outbid any team in the league.
Yes. I'm curious about Donovan Mitchell destinations, though, because as I look across the league, some of this goes to this, and I'll, let me ask you, because you were in the talent evaluation business for a long time and still are even in this role. But Donovan Mitchell, point guard, shooting guard, does it matter? I guess maybe it doesn't, but it does matter who you pair him with, right? And there's a reason that the Jazz went and got a Mike Conley. But there are times when it looks like, no, maybe it's better off just not to have a real point guard out there, and Donovan Mitchell should have the ball in his hands as much as possible. But he's not a defender. We already saw CJ McCollum, Dame Lillard, where that was a backcourt that had great firepower, but was limited in terms of its size and defense, and that hurt the Blazers ultimately. A CJ McCollum, Donovan Mitchell backcourt would be incredibly explosive, but the two of them plus Ingram plus Zion, I'm not seeing any defense there. So I don't know about that one. I don't know, like, every like player like this, we think, oh, it would be great with Miami. Imagine him next to Butler and Adebayo, and yet the Miami Heat are very strapped in terms of what they can send out, and how much does anybody want the hero Duncan Robinson package, right? Whatever else you can throw in. So I don't see a clean destination for him, but I do think some of it depends on whether a team is trading for Donovan Mitchell as an off guard versus a point guard, and who their other guard would be next to him to at least hopefully defend somebody in the backcourt. Is that a fair assessment?
It is a fair assessment. And one of the calculations that teams will go through, especially if you're in the front office in New Orleans or OKC, is if Donovan Mitchell, we've heard the rumors that he was maybe not quite as happy in Utah, even before this recent trade talk, that, you know, he had eyes in a bigger market. He's a New York kid. Well, if he wasn't enamored with being in Salt Lake City, would he be enamored with being in Oklahoma City or New Orleans? You know, so those are the calculations.
Yeah.
Obviously, the New York Knicks and the Miami Heat do not have those issues. So those are the challenges. But, yeah, I think he is a unique player, clearly gifted offensively, can shoot it, pass it, can score it. I think he is more wired to score than distribute. I think that's his best role as a scorer and a secondary playmaker, not the point guard that you put the ball in his hands. He brings it up the court, initiates the offense. I think one of the other underrated elements of doing that, Howard, that teams think about, I think more than I've seen fans and media discuss, is the wear and tear that takes on a player. For example, if Donovan Mitchell is the point guard opening night when the Utah Jazz or somewhere else and they're playing the New Orleans Pelicans, Jose Alvarado, a guy picking up full court like that and pressuring the ball and maybe getting steals or deflections, and then the guard having to get the team into his sets, you know, move guys around offensively and initiate the offense, that's a lot harder than most people think it is. So from a team perspective, you know, when you have a talented player like Donovan, in my opinion, he'd be better off as a secondary playmaker. Maybe he does that occasionally, but not for 48 minutes. Not, you know, you're not reliant on him doing that, because that takes away from some of his strengths, maybe gets him worn down. So I think ideally you'd play Donovan, and I have to, I guess, think of the specific player, but with a bigger guard who's wired to distribute, who can defend with some size and length, make a spot-up shot. You know, that's kind of, I think, the pairing. And then Donovan can be a secondary playmaker, score, and we know how dynamic he is, especially on a reversal when the ball goes to the weak side. He can catch and shoot. He can catch and crack off the dribble and hit a seam. I think that's his best role, and I think that's the role that teams will look at and try to fit him into, but it's obviously a little bit complex, especially at this later stage of the offseason.
I haven't looked at it all that closely, so I don't know best fits, but I mean, I could see him playing, you know, Kyle Lowry could account for some of that if he's with Miami, right? I don't know where LaMelo Ball will go eventually as a defender, but he's obviously big and long, and so if you have an undersized two guard in Mitchell, right? Like a bigger guard like LaMelo next to him, like that'd be a fun play for Charlotte. Obviously, Charlotte has other quandaries at the moment with their offseason that are complicated by some very serious issues. But yeah, I mean, I have to believe there will be a number of suitors out there. So I should ask you the inverse, though, of the Jazz desire for R.J. Barrett. And you said if you're Danny Ainge, you're not doing a deal without R.J. Barrett, in which case this thing could end very quickly. So if you're on the Knicks end of it, is R.J. Barrett actually untouchable? Is R.J. Barrett good enough to be untouchable? He's extension eligible. They haven't gotten it done yet. My colleague Michael Pina wrote a thoughtful piece this week on SI.com about why that may not be yet, why that extension is maybe a little more complicated, even though he's a third overall pick and has made some obvious progress in his game. Should R.J. Barrett be untouchable? And if he's not, if you're the Knicks and you're willing to do it because Donovan Mitchell is just that good, okay, but Mitchell plus Brunson plus Julius Randle and Mitchell Robinson is what exactly? I don't – like, you still have an all-star that you didn't have before and that you have not had for a while, right? Randle's 1 year notwithstanding. It's been since Carmelo Anthony that you had anybody to really hang your hat on. Mitchell would be that. But I don't – that team plus Mitchell, I don't know if it's that much better than what the Jazz have around Mitchell right now.
You make some good points. Yeah, I think that's absolutely something the Knicks will think about. And the next few weeks, maybe the next few days, will be very interesting for R.J. Barrett specifically, because as you mentioned, he is extension eligible. I like R.J. Barrett. But one of the things that I kind of get a chuckle out of now on the media side, Howard, is, and I still live in the Phoenix area, I see it with the Suns, you know, fans are asking, well, can we get Kevin Durant without Mikal Bridges? So the guys, you have to give something to get something. There are people on the other side of this thing who have jobs and families that depend on them doing hopefully a good job.
And owners who are telling them, you got him for, you gave up what, or you didn't give, you know.
Yeah, like, you have to give to get, especially, you know, Kevin Durant's at a whole different level. But,
yes.
You know, Donovan Mitchell, in my opinion, he has one of the best 20 or so players in the league. So with RJ, I think the question from the Knicks is this, and this has always been, I think, the pros and cons of R.J. Barrett as I've evaluated his game. I love his physicality. I love his toughness. I've heard great things about him. I like his intensity. I like his work ethic. How good will he be as a shooter? That's the question I've had with R.J. You know, the touch, the ball he shoots is a little bit hard. I like the kid a lot. I like his talent. And the Knicks, obviously Tom Thibodeau, Leon Rose have been around him for a few years now, but I think that's what they have to determine is – because as I evaluate the NBA, Howard, most of the elite perimeter players, and you put Donovan Mitchell in that category, obviously at the top of the list, Steph Curry, Devin Booker, those guys are maybe bad examples, but they're elite shooters, elite touch, James Harden. So if you're a non-center, say, really, the way the league is going, 1 through 4, and you're a average shooter, maybe even a below-average shooter, you know, how good can you be? How good can the team be in that construct? That's the challenge with RJ, and that's where it's hard projecting. And from my experience as an executive, a lot of the hardest extensions are for a very good player, but a guy you maybe don't think is quite a max player. That's hard because the player and his agent want the max. They're pushing for the max. But as a team, you say, geez, is RJ Barrett a max player? Well, maybe not, but we understand why he wants that. You know, those are the kind of machinations you go through from a front office perspective. So, I think the Knicks need to make a quick decision. Is RJ Barrett a guy we're going to pay at or near a max level? How good do we think he can be? We know him better than anybody. And if we just think he's going to be pretty good or okay, are we willing to put him in for Donovan Mitchell? Because if you put him in the deal as a centerpiece for Donovan Mitchell, that, in my opinion, will allow you to retain a lot of other things. Then you don't need to put in as many other draft picks and pick swaps. So to answer your question more directly, team with Jalen Brunson, Donovan Mitchell, Julius Randle, how good can they be? Well, if you have a lot of other things, then you can keep going because you have those guys under contract now for a number of years. You can keep adding to it and kind of building up from a position of strength.
Well, yeah, and on that note, like, I don't think anybody expects, and I've had some conversations about this week with folks out here in Vegas, like, I don't think anybody expects that the Knicks are going to be using most of those picks that they have accrued. They're looking to, repackage, repurpose those for veterans because that's the Knicks' way. They're not about the slow build for the most part. They're going to look for and that's the whole point of the Jalen Brunson thing, right? He's never going to be an all-star most likely, but they wanted a payoff now. And a trade for Donovan Mitchell is about trying to get a payoff now. And if you do get Donovan Mitchell, you definitely aren't waiting for those picks to become players and develop them. You're going to send them somewhere where you can get a veteran or multiple for them. RJ Barrett, it's interesting. Like, people around the league and people I know who are really high on him, even people in New York, I will say vaguely, who like him a lot, still feel like at the top end, he's maybe going to be a guy who makes an all-star team or two somewhere along the way, but is not going to be a perennial all-star. And if that's the case, if you're the Knicks, I think the calculation has to be, well, if he's not going to be a perennial all-star, if they are themselves convinced of that, or if the right people are convinced of that, he's definitely not untouchable at that point. I mean, I know you don't want to give up good young players when you're trying to build something out, and you want to add Donovan Mitchell or somebody to what you have. You don't want to have to give up a fundamental piece, and he is. Even if he tops out at a one-time all-star, he's still an important piece for them now. And, so I get not wanting to part with him, but I feel like it's automatic. Like, you have to, because the Jazz have to get something of value back. I also wonder if the part of the reason, or maybe the main reason why he hasn't been extended yet, is because he's easier to trade before you've extended him, right? Because now the Jazz can decide how much he's worth in an extension. And if you've already extended him to the max, for instance, that becomes a less valuable asset in the Mitchell trade. So I have to assume that there's at least some part of that that has influenced why he hasn't been extended yet.
Absolutely. And another macro factor, I would say, is we've talked about the Knicks for a decade or two now as free agent destination. We know what happened in 2019 with Kyrie and KD going across the river to Brooklyn. But if you have a team with Jalen Brunson, Donovan Mitchell, Julius Randle, and the ability to acquire a player, maybe it's an assign and trade, operate over the cap, do the Knicks become more of a destination again? And are they able to finally take advantage of being in Manhattan and the biggest media market in the country and in a place where, at least objectively, most free agents would like to play if they are able to? Can they finally cash in on that? It's difficult, if not impossible, to cash in on that. We say, well, we get a bunch of future draft assets and young players who may or may not pan out. Free agents in their prime don't want to hear that, right? Or players now in the modern NBA who are under contract but demand a trade with preferred locations like Kevin Durant, they want to go somewhere they can win. So that's the question with the Knicks. And then one final point I'd make, Howard, on a big picture macro level, I think the way the league is going, and I feel pretty strongly about this, is it's going to be less dependent on free agency and more dependent on trades. And the reason for that is because the contract numbers have gotten so staggering and so astronomical that most players, and we've seen it this offseason with a number of guys, Devin Booker, Karl-Anthony Towns, if I thought more about it, I could think of a few others, but who have signed extensions. Obviously, the guys who re-signed, Zach LaVine, Bradley Beal. But it's less of a free agency game because the money is so significant that for a team to blow open enough cap space to make it worth a player's while, especially a max player, while also trying to retain enough talent around him, it's virtually impossible. And now, we've seen one of the points of contention, obviously led by Kevin Durant in Brooklyn with the league, is players aren't waiting anymore. Ben Simmons in Philly, KD, even early after they sign extensions, they're asking for trades, demanding trades, in Simmons' case, choosing not to play. So I bring it up because I think the league has become more of a trading game. Can you trade your way to a championship rather than can you lean on a marquee market and blow open a bunch of cap space like the Miami Heat did in 2010 when they landed LeBron and Bosch in addition to Dwayne Wade? I think that model is less likely now, and I think the teams that execute the best either – you know, trying to get a free agent or develop a young player who becomes a star and then adding on top of that via trade, I think that's the preferred route and the most likely route to build a championship team.
So let me end on this note then. Let me ask you one more before I get you out of here. We have gone a little bit long, but I appreciate all the great insights. Kevin Durant demanded a trade. It may not happen. Or Adam Silver was funny about it the other night where he kind of corrected himself. Like, oh, it might have been a request. I don't know if it's a request or a demand. So like he was trying to soft pedal it. Semantics. But Durant just did this. Simmons did it a year ago, also with 4 years left on his deal. It used to be when if a guy requested a trade, demanded a trade, whatever, it was with a year left, and it was the Paul George model of telling the Pacers, hey, I'm going to leave anyway. You might as well get something for me now, which has at least some semblance of virtue to it and benefits both sides, right? But it's with 1 year left and clear leverage and the opportunity for both sides to do better for themselves. Then it became 2 years when Kyrie forced his way out of Cleveland and ended up with your old team, the Boston Celtics. And now it's just accelerated. Now it's just guys signed contracts and 5 minutes later, doesn't matter, I can still ask out. I don't know if there's an easy answer to this, but I'm sure you've spent some time thinking about this and I'm sure you've talked with your peers around the league about this. Do you and CBA talks are happening as we speak, more or less, and coming soon in earnest. Is there a collective bargaining agreement solution to this? I have to believe that the league, as much as they love the player movement and transactions and trade rumors and all that stuff, it keeps the world going round. But it's destabilizing. I'm sure that the Board of Governors and most GMs are not thrilled with the state of things. Is there a CBA solution to this to be found? And presumably one that the Players Association will actually sign off on.
I'm really glad you asked me this question, Howard, especially to finish up, because you know how we talk about Larry Bird rights and the Larry Bird exception and all that. I hope this is the Ryan McDonough rule if it comes into effect. I'm sure I'm not the first one who thought of it, but I will take credit for it. So let me back up. One of the things I realized when I was in Atlanta a few weeks ago covering free agency for NBA TV was, obviously we had a show planned to talk about Bradley Beal and Zach LaVine and Jalen Brunson. And then, as you know, right before the start of free agency, this KD trade demand / request, whatever you want to call it, news broke. And that, you know, obviously we changed our programming. And but what I realized, Howard, and this is like it was like a revelation, at least to me. I'm not that bright, but a light came on. I said, his contract extension has not even started yet. Think about that. He signed the contract extension last August, but we were talking about this in late June. The extension kicks in on July 1. So before his contract extension even started, the four-year extension, with the Brooklyn Nets a year ago, like he was asking for a trade. I don't think that's good for business, in my opinion. So my solution, the Ryan McDonough rule, is in the new CBA, and this would have to be collectively bargained, but in the new CBA, if a player signs a max contract, he is not eligible to be traded until there are 2 years remaining on the deal. And the reason for that is, going back to what you referenced with Paul George, is because with 2 years left on the deal, from a team perspective, you can get decent value as opposed to an expiring contract. And then from a player perspective, you can tip the team, say, hey, look, this isn't working out. It's not great for you. It's not great for me or both. Let's try to find a new home for a team that maybe has more of a future for me or where I'm a better fit. I just think if you – and that way it would take it off the table in both directions, Howard. So with 2 years left, so whether Philadelphia wanted to trade Ben Simmons or Ben Simmons wanted to trade – it can't happen. Same with Devin Booker in Phoenix or Karl Anthony Towns or Donovan Mitchell or Kevin Durant. Pick your player. Until there are 2 years left, he's not eligible to be traded. And I view it like a marriage or any kind of relationship where there are ups and downs. And putting in a rule like that, it's the biggest commitment you can make from a team to a player and player to a team, vice versa. It's the most significant commitment, so there should be a commitment. I think there should be a commitment where you want that money at that level. And people say, well, okay, well, what about player empowerment? Well, that's fine. Just sign shorter deals.
Yes.
Have the courage to do what LeBron James did. He's one of the only guys to do it. Just sign a bunch of one-year deals. I think Kevin Durant did the same thing with the Warriors. Sign a bunch of short-term deals. If you have the courage to do that, you have that hammer and that control over the franchise, then go ahead. But don't say this is a partnership and a marriage and, you know, we'll be here for 4 or 5 years and I love this franchise and then shortly into it demand a trade. I don't think that's good for the league, and I think and hope it's something that Adam Silver and his group will address in the next CBA negotiations.
I like the Ryan McDonough rule, Ryan McDonough.
I'm sure I'll get credit for it. No, they'll put it in the CBA.
I mean, they never actually even called, like, remember when they first did the amnesty clause, and we all called it the Allen Houston rule. I don't think they officially ever called it the Allen Houston rule, but maybe they should have. And then there was like using players who had been off the team, retired for years, but were still technically on the cap.
Keith Van Horn.
The Keith Van Horn rule, using him in a sign-in trade, and they finally outlawed that. So that was one of those. There's a bunch of them that have been kind of in. I think the Bird rule is the only one that actually carries the name of a former player. I don't think any others. There's the informal stuff, but I think it's the only other official one. So
maybe the Derrick Rose. I don't know.
The Rose rule,
with the rookie extensions. You know?
Yeah, I don't know if that's if there's any official NBA documentation that actually calls it that.
Right.
That one's great because it's alliterative, right? Like Rose rule just sounds good.
It does sound pretty good. Yeah.
I wonder how many fans of the NBA now maybe don't even realize that the Bird rights are actually about Larry Bird. Like, is it possible? it's almost so obscure now, like, because people don't know the genesis of it, which we don't know, need to go into. It's from 1,000 years ago. But no, I do think that there's merit to this idea that you can't trade a guy until he has 2 years left. It's not that long. Max contracts these days are 5 years for a guy with full Bird rights and 4 years otherwise. So you're not talking about that long before you get into it. And we're coming, and this is in a league where once upon a time contracts ran 6-7 years. And longer ago, they could go even longer. And so granted, you could trade guys throughout the life of those deals. But my point is just that once upon a time, a team was quote unquote stuck with a guy if they made a bad investment for a long time. And a guy might be stuck with a team because he was quote unquote untradeable because of his contract for a long time. So the idea of a limitation like that is not really, in the grand scope of things, all that crazy or limiting. And yeah, a four-year trial period that you're fully committed to because you are now ineligible to be traded or to trade is reasonable. Like, you just made a massive investment. You should be that confident on both sides of it. And yes, to your point too, you know, it used to be in this league because the salaries weren't as amazing as they are now. You always signed for as long as possible once upon a time because you wanted the long-term security and the financial security that could set you up for a lifetime. But given what players make now, not just the superstars, but and granted, this does not apply to the guys at the lowest end, but for a vast majority of NBA players, certainly everybody signing the mid-level on up, it's not that big of a risk anymore to go short. It's not that big of a risk when the mid-level exception is hovering in the $9 to $10 million range for a one-year contract. Granted, you might still lose future earnings for years to come if you blow out your knee, but even blown-out knees are not career-ending anymore. So, I mean, it used to be a trade-off. Long-term security for less freedom. In these days, with as much money as guys can make because of how well the league is doing, I think it's fair to say, if you don't want to be tied that long, then sign the one-year deal. Kevin Durant could have signed a shorter contract. Kyrie Irving could have signed, like, anybody, you know, Ben Simmons, whatever. Anybody who's that bent out of shape that soon, maybe you made the wrong decision. Maybe you should have gone short.
And one final caveat I'll make to put a bow on the rule and my thoughts on it is another way to have that flexibility and freedom as a player, you know, before you have 2 years left on your deal and you potentially can be traded then, do what James Harden did and sign a submax deal. I would only apply this rule to full max deals, whether that's, you know, 25, 30, 35% of the cap with 2 years left, you'd be traded. But if you want to take fewer years, you have more flexibility as a player and a right to demand a trade. Or if you want to take less money, if you want to take less than the max, like Harden did, then maybe you can be traded then. I do think there is some wiggle room there, because obviously from the NBA's perspective, this is probably not something that on its surface the Players Association would be thrilled about. But I think it's something the NBA should pursue for the good of the game. Because look, I mean, it's I view this totally different now, as you can probably imagine, on the media side for the last couple of years. On the team side, it's not fun. Just knowing at any moment, you know, a player could is as you pointed out, like early in the show, what makes somebody happy? What makes somebody unhappy? Why did this guy's mind change? I thought everything was fine. From an executive standpoint, the job is hard enough without kind of going through those machinations really at any time that a player signs a contract at that level. So if there's a way to take that off the table, put the focus more on the games, on the court, and less on the off-season trade speculation, who's happy, who's unhappy, was a trade requested or demanded, that's what I'd personally like to see.
Yeah, and then Adam Silver alluded to this the other day, that you know what, these trade demands requests affect other players too. So when you're talking about bargaining with the Players Association, you're not bargaining just with the top 20 players who are making all these trade demands. You're bargaining with the full 450 and their executive board and their executive director, and the greater good that all the players might actually agree to, even if the stars don't agree, might be, hey, we think you got to have limits on it because we're signing up for teams to come play with you and then you're bailing on us. So there's actually, like, maybe it's not that big of a fight for this one between the league and the union. Ryan, I've kept you way too long, but only because the information and the analysis is so great. Ryan McDonough of Ryan McDonough Rule fame. Thanks for spending the time.
Howard, always great to be with you. I enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Ryan McDonough. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.